Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In his first presidential visit to Ohio last week, Donald Trump unveiled the sketchy outline of his $1 trillion infrastructure plan. Just a few months ago, many predicted that this could be the issue around which both Democrats and Republicans, free spenders and budget hawks alike, could agree. But the plan so far is represented in just a six-page fact sheet. And it outlines federal spending of $200 billion over the next decade to address a vast array of projects, from roads and bridges to broadband and airports. The rest of the cost would be covered from other sources, including state and local governments, as well as private financiers who could charge tolls and fees. Politico reporter Lauren Gardner has been covering the issue. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
From a journalist's point of view, from where you sit, what's the overall price tag for fixing America's infrastructure? Has anybody put that into a dollar amount?
There are lots of estimates out there, but there's broad consensus that it's going to take trillions of dollars. Actually, a lot of critics of President Trump's plan say that $1 trillion is nowhere near enough to deal with just the backlog in how many pieces of America's infrastructure are just not in a state of good repair anymore, like the interstate highway system, like roads and bridges on a more local basis. So there is a broad consensus that it's going to take a lot of money, but some people would like to see even more than $1 trillion put into this.
Is the president touting this as the be-all, end-all, that a trillion's supposed to fix the problem, or is he saying it's just a start? How are they characterizing this?
The president's characterizing this as, you know, we haven't seen this level of investment from the federal government in the last decade or so, or, you know, even longer. So let's get this shot in the arm. And from his perspective, the way to do that is to not solely rely on federal funding, which has hovered around a few hundred billion dollars spread out over a few years every so often when Congress passes a highway bill. So the president thinks that if we go to other sources of funding, whether it's from the private sector or getting state and local governments to foot more of the bill, that will help kind of backfill the gap in funding.
So what has the reaction to his plan been on Capitol Hill so far?
To the details that are out there so far, the reaction's been a bit mixed. A lot of members are really excited about the overall price tag because $1 trillion in federal spending is not something members of Congress have been able to leverage when they've written these highway bills in the last several years. But rural state members in particular are very worried about the commitment to using private sector funding because they say, you know, in more rural areas, a private financier is not going to be able to recoup their money on something where if they charge a toll, they're not going to be making it back if it's a less populated area. They say that things like tolls work better in more populated areas like perhaps the Eastern Seaboard. So there's been some concern from lawmakers who represent those more rural areas of the country.
He particularly mentioned the rural America last week in Cincinnati, right?
He did. His administration last week took some pains to say, look, you know, we're not saying that this is all going to be private financing. They've committed to $200 billion. Over 10 years for just straight federal funding. And the administration has said that the bulk of that would go to places like rural America where it would be harder to attract that kind of private investment. Details are still a little bit scarce about how exactly that funding would be parceled out, but they talked about specifically giving grants and loans to rural America, dedicating $15 billion specifically to rural and also transformative projects. So they haven't made clear what constitutes a transformative project. But there definitely was an emphasis last week that, you know, rural America is special and different and has some different considerations from some of the things that we've been talking about.
Just to let our listeners know, we're talking about America's infrastructure issue today. My guest is Lauren Gardner. She's transportation reporter for Politico. She's been covering the president's proposal to spend about $200 billion over the next decade. That is $200 billion federal dollars to help fund a total $1 trillion infrastructure rebuild. It's a lot of money, but just a fifth of the overall plan, as I said, $200 billion. So talk a little bit more. I know it's just a 6-page memo, basically, but what are his ideas regarding private financiers?
There's an interest in tolling that's being put out there by the administration, which is a little new in that there's interest in tolling existing interstates. And there's been some pushback on that idea, especially from trucking groups that, you know, Americans have already paid for that infrastructure, so they shouldn't have to pay for it again. But there are some possibly members of Congress and also just some stakeholders out there that think, you know, maybe this is the way that we have to pay for this. So that was one idea that was included in the budget, you know, levying some kind of toll on existing roadways to help pay for those for rehabilitation. And that was one of the big ones. There's also been some suggestions for different ways to pay for the inland waterway system, a new fee.
That would be like the system that the barges use.
Mm-hmm, yes.
The locks and so forth.
The locks and dams.
They have said that in 2014, that should have been resolved, that question, that they're very opposed to it.
Yes, that's been a longstanding issue. And the thing to keep in mind with the president's budget is that every administration's budget is just a proposal. Congress has to act on the budget to set anything in stone. And while there's a range of ideas that the president put out there for ways to address infrastructure, at the end of the day, it's Congress that's going to be the ones to have the final say over how any of this plays out.
Just a couple months ago, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer was sounding pretty positive about an infrastructure. And like I said, it was supposed to be sort of this thing that brought everybody together. That doesn't seem to necessarily be the case. Is it the funding piece of it all, or are there questions about his priorities in general?
There are a lot of factors at play here. A lot of it seems to have to do with just the president's priorities in general and the Democrats' reaction to that. While there's been this broad level talk of how infrastructure could be a place where Democrats and Republicans could come together, you know, the president often takes to Twitter to criticize Democrats and other critics of his administration. And there haven't been many other policy areas where Democrats and Republicans have worked together thus far this Congress. So Democrats seem to just have a bad taste in their mouth of how, you know, why would we want to work with the administration on this issue? And there's also the question of, do they want to, coming up to the 2018 election? If they work with the president, they could get a legislative win, but that also involves working with the president. And would that play well in states where they have members up in tough re-election bids? So that's a calculus, too, that Democrats have to consider. But the funding piece is also a concern, too. Democrats have said they don't want to sign on to anything that's seen as giving huge tax benefits to private investors. And that's one of their critiques of the president's plan. So much remains to be seen before Democrats kind of take a more solid position on this. But thus far, it's been kind of half and half.
The air traffic control privatization proposal was rolled out first at the beginning of last week. Why do you think he did that way? I know there was already something in the pipeline, but that has not gone anywhere over the last several years.
That's right. This is largely based on a proposal by House Transportation Chairman Bill Schuster. He's pushed this plan the last couple of years. The administration's blueprint for this is largely based off that. There are very, very small differences there. And administration officials said last week, you know, this is a proposal that's been out there. It aligns with how we view infrastructure. So we decided, you know, let's go for this now. But there are, once again, some big concerns from a lot of rural state members, especially senators who have to represent a whole state. And if a state only has a couple of small urban areas, they have those big rural expanses to consider. And those rural pockets are typically served by general aviation, by small airplanes that shuttle people to different areas of the country. And general aviation has largely been opposed to this idea. They are opposed to anything that would charge them user fees. And there's been a lot of angst in that subsection of the aviation industry over this proposal.
The airlines are the ones in favor of privatizing the air traffic control, right?
They're big boosters of this. There's some other pockets that are supportive of this as well, or at least supportive of the concept. They've had some support from pilot labor groups and also from the Air Traffic Controllers Union. They supported Chairman Schuster's bill last Congress. They haven't officially signed on to the president's blueprint this time around because they want to wait and see what a bill actually looks like, but they have signaled support in the past.
Has he shared some thoughts about rejiggering the public funds piece of all of this, moving from the gas tax?
So the president mentioned the gas tax. At this point, it was a couple months ago, just kind of mentioned offhand, you know, the truckers would really like to see the gas tax raised or at least indexed to inflation, and just kind of put that out there, but didn't. Some people took that as a sign that the president might support that idea, but his wording wasn't a firm embrace of that concept, but it at least showed that he's heard from people who think that the gas tax should at least be raised to the point of inflation, and that he's heard that that suggestion. But other than that, he's not taken a firm position on whether the gas tax should be raised to help shore up the highway trust fund, if the country should move to more of a vehicle miles traveled fee to have drivers pay into the trust fund based on how much they actually drive. That's the concept that's been put forward in some states. So that's also been lacking in Congress, what exactly should be done to address the highway trust fund solvency. There are some members that have a lot of ideas and want to see certain things move forward, but there's been no push to actually see that come to fruition, which is why it's still a question that's hanging out there.
Why is it so hard for Congress to move forward on spending on infrastructure?
Because that would it would largely involve either raising taxes or, dedicating tax revenue to an infrastructure spending initiative and then having to cut spending elsewhere. And there's a lot of anxiety around raising taxes and not covering that. And also just there are so many discretionary programs that need federal funding. Where do you cut in favor of boosting spending on this priority? What moves down the priority list to help cover that?
So Congress sees this as a discretionary thing where they have a choice.
Yes, this isn't mandatory spending. It's not like the entitlement program.
Right. And they, I was driving over a bridge the other day. I'm sure you've seen them, too, where they have to have netting around the guardrails because they're crumbling so badly.
Yeah, members are definitely aware that there is an issue out there, but it always comes down to how you pay for it. You know, no matter how much support there is generally for the idea of putting money into this, there's always a question of, well, how do you pay for it? How do you pay off that credit card bill? And that's just been a perennial issue for Congress, especially these last several years where you've seen more and more just the state of some aspects of American infrastructure that just really need an overhaul.
As far as the miles traveled fees, who are big proponents of that besides the civil engineers and the industries that would benefit from it?
Well, they're certainly big ones. It's taken off a bit in Oregon. They have a program at the state level right now, but some states have had some privacy concerns with that issue. Privacy advocates or civil liberties advocates that are concerned that this could provide an avenue for the government to track where you are and take that basic information from you through whatever means they take to measure how much you've actually been driving. So that's been a barrier to this. But some members of Congress talking more and more about it as, this is probably what we should move to. But they still want to see it play out a little bit more on the state level to kind of get that public buy-in. But Oregon in particular is one area where it's really, it appears to have taken off.
Lauren Gardner, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Lauren Gardner, transportation reporter for Politico. Coming up, more conversation about how to fund, how to pay for, what the costs are to maintain and update and upgrade our infrastructure in the United States. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. President Trump has proposed investing $1 trillion to fix the U.S. infrastructure, including roads, waterways, bridges, and airports. Joining us is Director of the Cornell Program and Infrastructure Policy at Cornell University, Rick Geddes. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Great to be on.
Also with us by phone is the Managing Director of Government Relations and Infrastructure Initiatives at the American Society of Civil Engineers, Brian Palish. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
Brian, according to your group, the American Society of Civil Engineers, the U.S. infrastructure needs $4.6 trillion of work. That's more than the entire federal government spends in a year to fix the crumbling U.S. infrastructure. And this trillion-dollar plan from the Trump administration would only reach out about a decade in and of itself. So, I mean, how far behind is the United States? When should we have been starting to have these conversations? How many hundreds of years ago?
Well, I'm not sure it's 100 or hundreds of years, but I would say that I think...
Brian, could you pull your mouth away from the phone, please?
Sure.
Thanks.
As a nation, I think we've been underinvesting for about a generation. So one of my colleagues likes to say that we've taken a generation off of investing in the nation's infrastructure, sort of a vacation from our investment. And so it's really time to start focusing on building that infrastructure so we can improve our economy.
I was just talking with a political reporter. Nobody seems to want to spend the money that it's going to take. And are we talking about having to restructure how we fund these kind of things now?
Well, I guess I would say I think at the federal level there are people who are afraid to spend the money and afraid to make the decisions. I think what we've seen at the state and local level is state and local governments have been stepping up, and frankly, I think probably ending up putting a little more pressure on the federal government to start making some decisions. Almost 25 states in the last 4 or 5 years have actually gone out and increased their surface transportation spending. The voters in Seattle, Washington, and in Los Angeles, California, have voted to tax themselves to build out their transit systems. So I think if folks are given the right choices, the voters will actually support investing in our nation's infrastructure. And frankly, what we need is at the federal level, a little bit more courage from our federal legislators to actually make the decisions to spend the resources, and in fact, maybe in a few instances, raise some taxes like the federal motor fuels tax, which hasn't been raised since 1993.
Rick Geddes, we'll talk in more detail, but just raising—I mean, the gas tax is a very controversial issue. It's not raising what it once did, right?
That's right, Ann. There's a whole number of reasons why the federal gas tax, and keep in mind, consistent with what Brian just said, the states have their own taxes on both gas and diesel fuel. Mm-hmm. But there's also a federal tax on gas and diesel fuel. It's 18.4 cents per gallon. For gasoline, hasn't been raised since 1993. But there's a whole set of reasons, Ann, why the revenue coming into the Federal Highway Trust Fund from that tax has been declining faster than was predicted. We have now vehicles on the road, electric cars that burn no fossil fuel whatsoever. So they're still using the roads, but they aren't doing that. And additionally, both at the end of the second term for President George W. Bush and early in President Obama's term, both presidents separately increased the stringency of what are called CAFE standards, which stands for Corporate Average Fuel Economy, which is urging, indeed requiring, the car manufacturers to make their engines more efficient and their cars more efficient. And the companies have responded by doing so. But of course, that means that they are burning less gasoline, which is, you know, using gasoline is the source of the tax. There's other reasons. We think we're not quite sure why it happened, but around 2005 or 2006, annual VMTs, which are vehicle miles traveled in the United States, which have been increasing sort of consistently through recessions and downturns since the Second World War, peaked out and started to decline. And so whether that's because younger people are more connected and they don't drive as much as young people did before is unclear. But we know that's happening. The other part, Ann, is that most state gas taxes and the federal gas tax are not indexed to inflation. So even if you have modest inflation over a long period of time, as we've had since 1993, the actual purchasing power of those taxes when you go to actually reconstruct, you know, renovate an infrastructure facility is less than you would have before. So there's this confluence of reasons, Anne, that the gas taxes are not doing what they have in the past to help with infrastructure.
The American Society of Civil Engineers gave the United States a D-plus in its 2017 infrastructure report card. I've covered these things for years. Where are the worst problems, Brian Palish?
Well, I think from our report card and the way we view our report card, the lowest grade in this version of the report card, which comes out every 4 years, was transit with a D-. And what we've seen in the last 4 years is a number of the older legacy transit systems, think Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., are really facing the signs of their age and the underinvestment in the normal operating and capital investment that they need to make. And so these transit systems are really struggling to keep up not only with the ridership demands, but also just the age of their systems and the fact that they haven't been maintained. In addition to that, we also saw the grade for parks and recreation, which is, people like to use their parks and recreation facilities. We saw that grade go down in this last report card as well. So those areas are of concern. But also we saw with roads and bridges, the fact that you know, what we're doing is we are seeing a little bit more congestion in our road system, which is causing issues. And frankly, the pavements are not maintaining themselves as well either. And so what we have is rougher roads, which leads to more damage to our vehicles when we're driving.
Do you think, Brian Palish, that people have a really good sense about what we mean by infrastructure in the United States? Because you're talking about, you know, then there's also broadband, there's airports, there's, you know, just a huge swath of the United States is made up of infrastructure.
Right. You know, I guess what I think is we don't worry about infrastructure if it doesn't bother us, if that makes sense. And what I mean by that is, you know, we wake up in the morning, and I woke up this morning and I put on a pot of coffee and I jumped in the shower and then I got on the road, and that was my first bad interaction with infrastructure in the morning, was getting in my car because I got stuck in traffic on the way to work this morning. I live in Washington, D.C., so we have one of the worst situations for traffic in the country. And so I think really folks know enough about infrastructure. And in fact, what we've found in the time that we've done this report card, which dates back to 1998, is that folks actually are having a better understanding of the fact that we do have issues with our infrastructure. We saw, obviously, the water infrastructure causes, we've seen issues with that, whether it be in Flint, Michigan, or just with significant water main breaks in cities that get reported on the nightly news. The reality is, I think people do know the infrastructure, is they interact with it every day, but it's not something they think about unless it's probably a negative interaction, not a positive one, right?
But Rick Geddes, when we're talking about infrastructure, funding comes from different places depending on what kind of infrastructure we're talking about. I mean, aren't we, in general, when we talk about it, we're talking about the gas tax, we're talking about things to fix roads and bridges. That doesn't necessarily apply to airports and water systems, does it?
Yeah, you have to be real careful here, Anne. And I know that Brian is limited in singing his own praises because that would be unseemly. But I would recommend all the listeners go to the ASCE website and look at the report card, not that Brian is referring to, but not only because of, you know, the poor quality of the infrastructure, but the variety of infrastructure that we have in the country. And I think the ASCE report card is good for that too, which includes dams, levees, airports, seaports, roads, bridges, tunnels. But Anne, it also includes what we call social infrastructure, like schools, prisons, courthouses, standalone facilities like that. So there's and of course, the electric grid is out there, and also natural gas pipelines and on and on. So there's a whole lot of aspects of the U.S. economy that really fall under the heading of infrastructure. So when you ask, you know, a question about how is it funded, you have to be careful, because that's going to depend on the specific type of infrastructure that you're referring to. It's going to vary widely whether you're talking about a port or an airport or a road, a bridge or tunnel. And so, but what the way to think about that question, Anne, I think is very important. And the question for me is the distinction between some type of user fee. So is it the users of the facility who are paying for it? So do we have a toll on a bridge, a toll on a road, or is it the users of the port, the, you know, the companies that are unloading their cargo there that are paying for the port? Or is it some broader-based tax that the relevant unit of government, state, federal, or local government is dedicating to that but is not really correlated to use? So one of the things your previous guest, Lauren, brought up that I think is very important is that some states are moving away from gas taxes, which are becoming less and less correlated with the use of a road, mm-hmm. and more towards something like a road usage charge or a mileage-based user fee. It's also called a VMT fee. So there's different words for that. But, you know, most policy people like the idea of the person who uses the road, the facility of paying for it, because – and that's pretty familiar. If you buy a dozen eggs, you're going to eat the eggs and you're going to pay for the eggs. So that's like a user fee. But also for our utilities and like electricity, we pay per kilowatt hour. We pay per minute of cell phone use. We pay per therm of natural gas. In my house, we pay per gallon of water that we use. So Americans are pretty used to the notion for a utility of paying per unit used. And that's why I think the issues that Lauren mentioned regarding the state of Oregon, but also other states like Minnesota and California, are looking at these types of alternative fees. But the key, Anne, is that it's some type of user fee that actually pays for the infrastructure. So I think that's very important.
Do user fees affect people differently? For instance, a sales tax affects somebody with a low fixed income differently than it would somebody with a large discretionary income.
Sure. So we care about what the progressivity or regressivity, Anne, mm-hmm. of the tax when we impose it. So one of the things with road usage charge, you know, the question you always want to ask is compared to what? In other words, if you say, well, gas taxes, we should raise the gas tax, you then have to look at the regressivity of the gas tax compared to some other way of funding the roads. So one of the things with the gas tax, you'll notice the Obama administration over 8 years did not aggressively push to raise the federal gas tax. Mm-hmm. And I think one explanation for that is it's becoming more of a regressive tax. In other words, a person with a Tesla, which I think we all know is a reasonably expensive car, is not going to pay anything additional if we raise the federal gas tax. But I live in upstate New York, and some of the communities out here that have an old Ford F-150 pickup truck that does not get very good gas mileage, they're going to pay a lot more if we raise that gas tax. So the gas tax has become, I think, less fair since it was really increased in 1956 by President Eisenhower to pay for the design and construction of the interstate highway system. So we have to be very careful of that. And the other thing, Anne, is we can do things if we move more towards user fees that you know, help people of lower incomes, whether it's through some sort of voucher or credit on their bill. And we do that, Anne. We do that for electricity. We do that for water, for other types of utilities, because we do care about poorer households that can't afford these basic services.
Brian Palich, when it comes to the big push and pull of mass transit versus roads and highways, there's the philosophy that, hey, if we keep fixing and we keep building roads and highways and overpasses and all of that, which they're constantly doing in Central Ohio, that there's not going to be the impetus for mass transit.
Well, I mean, I think the way we look at the whole issue of transit is really providing people choices in their commute and choices in the way in which they want to move around their cities. And when you look at rural areas, we have an aging population. In a rural area, transit actually provides people the ability to be more mobile when maybe they can't drive anymore. And so, you know, as I stated earlier, I live in Washington, D.C., going a day without Metro, which we did about 18 months ago when they shut down Metro for a day for safety reasons, was not a very pleasant day on the roads because a lot of people use our transit system. And so I don't think it's an either-or situation. I think it's a yes-and situation where we do need to improve our transit systems because that ultimately is going to help the road system be more efficient as well.
John and Galena, you're on the air. Hi, John. What do you think?
Yeah, hey, Hey, Ann, I have a comment about how we got into this situation where we don't have any money to pay for the upgrades that we need. A couple decades ago, Grover Norquist formed a political organization that ended the career of any Republican who raised taxes one iota, from dog catcher all the way to president. And, you know, the Democrats also turned tail and ran away from tax increases, too. And, you know, from then until now, raising taxes has been the political third rail. But the fact is, we need taxes to build the kind of country we want. And if we're going to make these improvements, that's the realization that has to happen before we can get started.
Are you talking strictly taxes, or are you saying also things like user fees and that sort of thing?
Well, the reason we're in a conversation about user fees is because nobody wants to do the politically hard thing of, you know, having a real conversation about why we don't have any tax revenue coming in. Mm-hmm. And it's because I trace that back to, you know, Grover Norquist and his efforts to make raising taxes for building the kind of country that we want politically impossible almost.
Was there a thank you, John and Galena, for that. Brian Pallish, before I let you go, was there a tipping point? Was there a time when, you know, Congress, the federal government was keeping up with things and then things started to fall apart, fall behind as the gas tax wasn't updated, that kind of a thing?
Well, I mean, I certainly think with our road and transit and bridge infrastructure, which is what the gas tax funds, the federal motor fuels tax funds, I think, you know, you can look back to 1993. That's the last time that it was raised. Mm-hmm. Since that time, we've lost purchasing power. So think, you know, folks who are listening, think about what your 1993 salary was and think if you hadn't gotten a raise since then, if you would, how you would be doing in today's economy. Well, that's kind of what where the gas tax is, if you will. We've lost about 40% of the purchasing power of that revenue. Yes, there are cars that are more efficient. Yes, we have issues with you know, sort of flat vehicle miles traveled and increasing fuel efficiency, but the reality is that tax has really lost its ability to maintain our system. So you can sort of look back to 1993. Now we've done some things. Congress has done some things to sort of fill in the hole of the Federal Highway Trust Fund. But what we really need to do at the federal level is have a conversation about what's going to be the federal role in addressing the problems that we have with our nation's infrastructure, starting probably first with roads, bridges, and transit, because that's where the greatest need is. And, you know, we think, and we're simply put, we think we should raise the federal motor fuels tax. It is not a long-term solution. I think Rick mentioned vehicle miles traveled or road user charges, and Lauren was talking about that before. Those are steps for the future. We can't implement those things today. And so it's sort of a two-step process where we need to get ourselves through this this need to rebuild our infrastructure while we plan for the future where we might, in fact, implement a road user charge.
Brian Pallish, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Brian Pallish, Managing Director of Government Relations and Infrastructure Initiatives for the American Society of Civil Engineers, will have a link to their 2017 Infrastructure Report Card for the United States. Rick Geddes, Director of Cornell Program and Infrastructure Policy, College of Human Ecology at Cornell University, is going to stay with us. And then joining us coming up, Ohio Department of Transportation Director Jerry Ray. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle mostly agree that America's infrastructure needs fixing. President Trump was in Ohio last week promoting his plan to invest $1 trillion in the nation's infrastructure, but just one-fifth of the price tag would be covered by federal funds. We're going to talk about how to cover the rest of the cost. We're going to focus on Ohio, arguably a crossroads for the nation. Still with us is the director of the Cornell Program and Infrastructure Policy, Rick Geddes. Thanks again, Rick, for joining us.
Great to be here, Ann.
And joining us now is Director of the Ohio Department of Transportation, Jerry Ray. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Director Ray, how do you rate Ohio's infrastructure?
We are actually in very good shape. Our roads and bridges are all rated on average, above average, so we're in pretty good shape. We always have work to do. Roads and bridges are like so many things in life. They don't get better with age, so they need to be maintained and repaired and eventually replaced, and we're diligent about doing that.
Give listeners a sense about what the Ohio Department of Transportation budget is. It's separate from others.
We have about a $7 billion biannual budget, and we spend about a little over $2 billion. We have in recent years, I should say, spent a little over $2 billion annually on our contract construction program to maintain and repair and improve our transportation system from a capacity standpoint and a safety standpoint. The important thing for your listeners to know is that 93% of that of those resources, of those dollars, go towards just taking care of what we have.
Maintenance.
Maintenance and repair and replacement of the existing structures, of the existing roads and bridges. If you think about it, down through the ages, down through the decades, the people of Ohio have made an enormous investment in their transportation infrastructure. And at ODOT, we talk about taking care of what we have, and that it's our job to protect that investment, just like you would protect the investment in your home by replacing the roof or mowing the grass or all the other things that you do to maintain.
How well is Ohio keeping up in terms of generating revenue from the state tax and as far as state gas tax and as far as its take from the federal?
Well, we've done very well recently because we haven't had an increase in the gas tax. However, we have been able to have, again, a $2 billion annual program. During the first 6 years of the Kasich administration, we've invested a total of over $12 billion in our transportation infrastructure.
And that's paid for, or are there bonds and other
there
financing?
There are bonds involved with leveraging the turnpike. So we've invested that much. By the time Governor Kasich is out of office, we will have spent in the neighborhood of $16 billion in transportation infrastructure. Now, we're able to do that by efficiencies within our own department, moving money from operations to our contract program or capital program.
The actual in construction.
Right. Yeah. And back in the early 2011-2012, you may recall that we had a bill through the Ohio General Assembly that allowed us to sell bonds against the revenue from the Ohio Turnpike. And that's been a big, big help to us. So we've had a very aggressive, robust program for several years now.
Rick Geddes, selling the revenue from bonds on the Ohio Turnpike, that's the sort of thing that President Trump is suggesting in his very sketchy plan.
Well, Ann, I think what you may have in mind there is the notion of a public-private partnership.
Yeah.
And that's a term that has been, you know, utilized a lot in the transportation infrastructure delivery world. And again, you have to be a bit careful because the way, you know, there's funding of infrastructure and there's financing. And
yeah,
the funding refers to the underlying dollars that you and I were talking about before, which could come either from some user fee like a toll or a road usage charge, or from dedicated tax revenues, something like that. And then once you have that toll revenue in place, you can go to the bond markets, to the tax-exempt municipal bond markets, often in the case of infrastructure, and you can borrow at relatively low rates in order to do your renovations or to design and construct a new facility. So those tax-exempt bonds, Ann, are financing. So the traditional way in the United States that ODOT and other DOTs as well as states and cities have proceeded to finance their infrastructure is to have some sort of user fee or something like that, and then to go to the tax-exempt municipal bond markets. That's a bit unusual, Ann, in the sense that other countries don't have that tax exempt status for publicly issued debt versus privately issued debt. And so what other countries have done, and the U.S. increasingly is doing, is bringing in the private sector to do more things. So the private sector might bundle together the design, the construction, and the operation and maintenance of a particular transportation facility over a certain period of time, say 25 or 30 years. But then you could also toss in the financing of that end. So what they would do is take the toll revenue, they would go to the capital markets, they wouldn't just use tax-exempt debt, they would use their own debt, but they would also have some actual equity in that project. And they would design, operate, finance, and maintain the project over, you know, some time frame. The Indiana Toll Road is a pretty well-known example of that. I could give you other examples. There's a case of design construction of a new facility, which is the added lanes on the Washington, D.C. Beltway on the Northern Virginia side, which was done at very little cost to the state of Virginia. So that second piece of it, Ann, is really the public-private partnership notion. And a lot of states and cities in the United States are exploring that alternative delivery approach, which has been used so much in other countries.
What about in Ohio? How do you think it would go over if more roads and bridges, Director Ray, if they could recoup the costs with tolls and fees in Ohio? Do you see that as a possibility here?
Certainly, I see it as a possibility. People beginning to understand that there has to be a way to finance the maintenance and the expansion of the system. There's also a sense, I think, that the gas tax, which has been a very reliable source and a good combination of sort of user fee and progress, is not quite as adequate as it used to be because of more fuel-efficient vehicles. The use of the gas tax dollars has become spread to other things other than just the movement of people and goods. So it's not quite the vehicle that it once was. So people are beginning to understand that we're going to have to look at other ways to finance projects.
Why? How has gas tax dollars been spread more thinly? How was that done? Congressional action or?
When I say that, I'm talking about the federal. We get
federal, right.
We get funds from the fuel tax at the state level and the federal level. At the federal level, at the Ohio level, we have a constitutional exclusion that it has to be used for a roadway purpose.
Right.
At the federal level, they have various programs and projects, and all of them good programs, projects, and programs that are well-meaning, but we end up with federal gas tax dollars in bike paths and pedestrian paths and building dog parks and a lot of different things because of the various environmental concerns and the type of quality of life things, which are all good things. However, that begins to dilute the actual purpose of the tax in the first place, which is the movement of people and goods from place to place.
What about, and Rick Gaddis, correct me, the vehicle miles traveled kind of approach? Yeah, Jerry.
There's been a lot of discussion and analysis and debate about that for probably 20 years now.
Yeah.
And I believe that it's a difficult vote for members of the Congress or for a state legislature, but it also is changing in the sense that the technology to do that is here now, so that you could actually pull up to the gas pump. Your credit card would already be registered with the gas pump. Your vehicle would talk to the gas pump, and it would know how many miles you've traveled since the last time you refueled, and you could get a vehicle miles traveled tax. Now, the technology's there. The law and the protocols and what would happen, is it going to be federal? Is it going to be state? Is every state going to be the same? That's the difficult part, is the legislative part.
And also, Lauren Gardner from Politico brought up the privacy concerns.
Correct. Everybody's concerned about that.
Yeah.
So, Ann, if I could just add a footnote to what Mr. Ray said. You know, it's interesting because, as was mentioned by Lauren, the state of Oregon has been a leader in trying to move from a per-gallon charge on either gas or diesel fuel to a per-mile charge, and it's been very challenging to get people to accept that, even though, you know, it sounds like that's pretty simple. They have a set of ways of dealing with the privacy issue, and you can sort of have a menu of choices, one which would just monitor your speedometer. So if you know what the speedometer is doing, you can easily, through arithmetic, figure out the number of miles that have been traveled. The system does not have any idea of where your vehicle actually is. And then at the other end of the spectrum, of course, most personal electronic devices these days have a navigation function that is highly accurate based on satellites and can really tell where your car is and charge you on that basis. So there's sort of this menu approach, Ann, in terms of you can dial in how much privacy you want to have. There's even what I call the all-you-can-eat version of mileage-based user fees where you pay, you know, like a monthly or quarterly fee and they don't monitor anything. You can drive as much as you want if you pay that fee, which is maximum privacy. The other interesting thing about that, Ann, is that we are seeing sort of people accept a toll or a road usage charge on a new facility, like a new lane, a managed lane or what they call hot lane conversions. But people seem to resist for reasons that remain unclear to me, shifting for existing lanes, existing capacity from that per gallon fee to a per mile fee.
Are you talking about those lanes that I see around Virginia and so forth that are for commuters and they pay extra so that they can drive a faster lane?
Right, and that's been done a lot in Texas, and around Austin and Dallas as well, where you'll have a congested interstate with what are called GPLs or general purpose lanes, two in each direction. But a private company will come in and use that right of way in the median at very little cost to the public sector and install managed lanes where the toll actually varies in real time with the current level of traffic. As added capacity in addition to the general purpose lanes. So the idea is that takes some pressure off of those congested general purpose lanes for people who are willing to pay the toll. But you still have those free lanes available to you. So we're seeing a lot of that, Ann.
Yeah, Director Ray?
Well, and I agree with what he just said. People, when we were trying to explain to the folks in Northern Ohio what we wanted to do with the Ohio Turnpike, we had a lot of meetings. In fact, we had over 100 meetings across Northern Ohio with citizens and leaders, and we had a lot of feedback. And one of the things that we heard from them was, look, we already paid for this road. We don't want to have to pay for it again. So that was the perception. What we tried to explain that we can leverage this asset to the benefit of the entire state, just like they, borrow money to buy a home. You leverage the assets you have, and we eventually won the debate. But it wasn't easy to convince folks that they should. We should take advantage of what's already been built.
The point being that we'd paid tolls for years upon years upon years. The turnpike was paid off.
Correct.
All things being equal, and except for the ongoing maintenance, and that the company that took it over, that you leveraged it to, they maintain it or the state maintains it?
Well, in our case, no, we did something different.
Okay.
We just, all we did was sell bonds against the future toll revenue. So the turnpike's still there, still being maintained the same way, still be charging tolls as they always have. So all we did was sell bonds against future toll revenue.
And just real quickly, Director Ray, the larger philosophy about building more roads, if you build it, they will come, versus expanding mass transit in the state of Ohio as the population grows, as it will eventually.
We are very, very careful about adding to the system. I mean, it involves safety and congestion and genuine purpose and need. So we're careful about the projects that we do simply because we want to be careful with what we're doing to the state, but also with the money that we have. So I think that the balance is going to sort of change as we go along in the urban areas, as lifestyles change and more people choose to live downtown. We need a connected system. We need a multimodal system. But in order to make the transit systems work and make them financially viable, we need a lot more people riding them than we currently have, or a lot more than even projections show that we could get.
Ohio Department of Transportation Director Jerry Ray, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And Rick Geddes, Director of the Cornell Program and Infrastructure Policy at the College of Human Ecology at Cornell University. Thanks to you as well. I really appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Ann. Great to be on.
That's it today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.